Well, first about the cyberfeminist pioneer, that is not quite true because cyberfeminism was invented in the early 90s by the Australian artist group Vienna's Matrix and also Sadie Plant, the English cultural theoretician. She also used the term and wrote a book to kind of conceptualize it. That were both approaches that were for me, I mean, I liked it, but it was not really super thrilling. I thought something else needs to be added or it needs to be opened up. And that's why we founded in 1997, which was already basically 5 years after the term started to circulate. We started the Old Boys Network in Berlin with actually some of the members of Vienna's Matrix and some of the members of my earlier artist group, which was called Women in Technology. And the network was not an artist group or a collective, but it was, I mean, we founded the network and we had a core group. And the idea was of the core group that we organize international events and a platform or various platforms over the years where people could meet and exchange and discuss. And the purpose of the whole thing was that we said we want to open up cyberfeminism not only to be what Sadie Plant had suggested or what we in his Matrix were practicing, but we said, okay, imagine the term cyberfeminism would be totally blank, you know, nothing on it. And we give it to you and you think what you want it to be. And then we all meet and discuss what we bring together on the table. So that was the idea, to not be become a follower of something or an adept, but really to activate people to think about what they wanted it to be. And that was the main idea of the Old Boys Network. I started to study art before people had computers in the 80s. What I already had was a camera, and I was very much into photography, and I loved handling the camera, so that's also a technology. And then when I started to study in Hamburg, we at the art school, we got a first media lab with some Macs in them. That must have been around 1990 or something. And the lab was immediately populated by young men who were sitting all day in front of the computers. And we were like, that's interesting. What is it? How does it work? You know, what is going on? And when we approached them and said we would be interested in working, then they would say, oh, you know, it's not so easy. Not everyone can do it. Like, you know, women. And we felt a bit frustrated, and the whole climate around that was more, you know, closed doors, and it was not very inviting. It was immediately this atmosphere which I would meet so often in the years later and in the decades later. Mm-hmm. You know, that the atmosphere around technology was making a mystery of technology, was kind of closing doors, was, you know, I'm not telling you how I do it, read the fucking manual. I had to learn it myself, so you learn it yourself. And this whole attitude, you know. So that started at the art school, and then I had several colleagues, friends, fellow art students, and we started a group out of our frustration in practice. We started a group that we called Women in Technology, and it was more a reading group and a research group. So we started, you know, we wanted theoretically to understand what technology was. You know, well, we could not have access to the computers. So we started to read philosophy of technology and contemporary media theory. And that was all interesting, but not super satisfying. When you're an artist, you want to do something. The group was still mixed, but then some people stayed away and it became more intense. And we decided we turn the reading group into an artist group, and we do things together. And then we founded, the first thing we did, we founded the Institute for Women in Technology at our art school, which was just a virtual institute. It was just a name. And then we designed our, our outfits, and we developed a brochure, and we got merchandising articles printed with Women in Technology, and we made ourselves available for, you know, signing postcards and all that. So it was not so much content yet. We didn't do much. The main thing we did actually was kind of drawing attention to the fact that there was some misbalance, you know, some imbalance in this relationship between gender and technology. And that caused a lot of attention. And we got into invitations to do performances, and so we all of a sudden, you know, just through using this name Women in Technology, where, you know, we became not famous, but on a, let's say, on a local level, you know, people invited us to do things, and then we had a local TV station also, so we started to work on local TV shows, and things evolved, and then there was an art television program at the Documenta in 1992, and we got invited to do art television, and oh my god, what shall we do? You know, we don't have a body of work, or we didn't have a real concept or anything. Basically, we did not know what we were doing. You know, we were just trying and testing. And then we were just thrown into this, and we did. We came up with a series of interactive television shows that were called Envy of Penis Games. We come across Freud in our reading group, and you know, the relation to technology and Lacan, and of mm-hmm. course technologies and compensation for missing penis, and so we turned this around and made it into the title of our interactive television shows. So that's how it all started. It was not really explicitly feminist in the beginning. It just happened to be that as female students, we shared the same experiences that made us uncomfortable. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we started from there. And it was only after a while that we kind of realized that this has something to do with misogyny in general, and in particular with a very disturbed relationship between, you know, gender and technology. It's totally uneasy, and it still is. I think what changed is that now everyone is handling technology on a daily basis. You know, we have mobile phones in the pocket, where everyone, you know, almost as a tablet or an ebook reader and a computer. So not in terms of using technology, you know, becoming consumers of technology. I think everyone is a consumer of technology, more or less. I mean, small children, old people, you know, women, of course, too. Yeah. The barrier is no longer in using technology, I would say. But the problem really still is the development or the design of technology. You know, you'll find very few information scientists and computer engineers, very few hardcore programmers. Today, less women study programming and information science than, say, 25 years ago. And I only met very recently a young woman who told me that she dropped out of her studies because she simply could not stand the climate that was there in Germany. I'm also aware that it's very different in different countries. You know, in the former Eastern Bloc, it's very different. In countries like India, Malaysia, is a very different climate. Loads of women are doing that. It's mainly, it seems to be mainly a problem of the Western world, that they you know, or we, or whoever. I mean, there is a tradition that technology is equaled with manliness in a way, you mm-hmm. know. If you know to handle technology, that is cool, that makes you very male. And that obviously causes problems for women who want to be good with technology, mm-hmm. real techies, because either they start to behaving like males in their social environments, or they are not taken serious. So this social component, because technology doesn't, you know, come as a gadget, you know, which is totally neutral and innocent. It's always embedded in a large culture of how is it developed, who develops it, for what purpose, and how is it used, and you know, what is the whole knowledge system around it. And this is what keeps women away. It's the climate, it's not the technology. And this is, as I said, on the side of the use, I think the barrier is not there anymore. And I think industry has made sure that they are targeting women, because, you know, women have jobs and money and they can buy things. So they would be very stupid not to sell their gadget to us. But when it comes to the inside, nothing changed. And I really do not very clearly understand why this is the case, you know. I don't understand, except that there is this connotation of manliness and, you know, that is related to technology. But why? I mean, I don't know why it needs to be kept up in that way. After my PhD and my research on copyright and art, I realized that I wanted to move on from the question what artists can use to develop their work, which is often limited through copyright. You know, when they do a remix and sampling and collage practices, you easily get into this gray area where you don't know is this still legal or not. So that was my whole, you know, 5-6 years almost of PhD research. And then I realized I want to move on from the question what an artist can take to a broader question that concerns the whole society. So I shifted the question from what artists can take to the question of what artists can contribute to a free culture, that's what I called it, and to the exchange of knowledge. And I started a search for art projects that are kind of active in this field, and started to do interviews with these artists to introduce their project and do research about their projects. And that was my first project in the field, which was called Giving What You Don't Have. In the sense of artists were creating platforms to exchange knowledge, or archives where they made things accessible. They are developing tools, or they create spaces or educational situations where knowledge is shared. So that was my approach. And only after or during the work of this first smaller project, I came across the term commons again and looked into it, and I thought, this is pretty much where I am and what I'm doing. So let's try and start using it. It was still not, you know, it was an experiment. And so I called my work, slowly started to call it to be about art and commons, and looking deeper into the commons and into the commons research and literature. It's a historical concept. It's a concept that very often refers to land, to water, to natural resources of different origin. But there's also a very important part of the commons are the digital commons, you know, free software and shared information. And then I thought, okay, yeah, that's really an interesting concept, because it, in historical aspect, it refers back to a society which is pre-capitalist, you know, where where not everything was about private ownership, where people shared things in a way, and that is only really referring or mostly to smaller communities. It was not necessarily a concept for to run a whole society, you know, or a whole country. So it's the idea of the commons is to have small entities of people who ideally know each other and, you know, deal with resources in a way that they, you know, they negotiate with each other. And I thought that was a quite nice, that this basically is a very nice idea. And everyone who ever tried that knows how hard it is and impossible almost, you know, not to start fighting over things and all of that. But that is how it has to start. You mm-hmm. know, that's how everyone, I think, has to learn where it makes sense to share and how to do it in a good way. So it's good for everyone and not just for the one with the most, you know, power or physical strength or whatever. So that was the starting point. And so still I'm doing both. I'm looking into the commons to develop the commons conceptually, because that is a term which popped up all of a sudden a few years, or let's say 10 years ago, mm-hmm. in the context also of digital commons, but also looking back to, you know, looking into different countries all over the world and looking into their traditions of the commons. And it's still a very kind of vague concept that different people use in different ways. But I think it's, and also it's interesting because it transverses different disciplines. You know, it has to do with political science, how do you organize society, mm-hmm. what is politics, has to do with economics, with all kinds of, you know, with law, of course, with many different disciplines. And my question is also what I'm doing, on the one hand, try to develop this conceptually further, and on the other hand, see how art and art projects can work in this field and do something, make interventions or make suggestions. I sometimes use also the concept of speculation, you know, for the art projects that I'm investigating, saying they have a speculative aspect in the sense that they are trying and testing something that might be the future. It of course does not really totally work in the society we have at the moment, because it's built on totally different paradigms. So it's not a solution at the moment, but it's partial small solutions that kind of speculating on the future. And that's what I'm exploring, and I'm using, I think the art world is interesting, or to kind of confront these two concepts, the commons and the art, is interesting and challenging because they are so contradictory in the way how they work. I mean, nothing can be more hierarchical, I think, than the art world, and mm-hmm. exclusive, and the commons is the opposite. So that was one reason, for example, why I put this three, or I made this, I produced these three interviews for the exhibition with the three curators, because they are all three working in that field of bringing commons and art together, and I wanted them to really explain how they do it and what the problems are, you know, the conflicting points. And I'm looking into specific art projects that exist. This is part of my research, and the Commons Lab is an attempt to create a temporary situation to use the resources from the art world, like space and a little bit of money, to create a space in which things can happen, things can be produced together, in that case an exchange about knowledge. So what I did here, I invited as many people as I could, you know, meet in a city I've never been before. I didn't know anyone. So, but I trusted that I would, you know, plant the seeds and, you know, spread the word. And then I had in the beginning, when I came here, this lecture at Concordia, which was well attended, and some people approached me after that and came to the lab. And so I slowly built a small network about exchange. And the idea is then to capture these conversations. I was running two workshops that will be also, you know, I'll recorded them and I will not publish them, but I will kind of try to think what actually happened and extract some, you know, ideas for further work and make things available. And the stuff is all, what remains is the website. I was thinking of how I would structure the work, and I decided to do different things. I gave two lectures, which is a very one-sided. I say something, someone else has to listen. That was mainly to, in the first lecture, to introduce the background of the commons, like to lay out the theoretical background. And the second lecture was about my art practice and the history of that. The second format was the three interviews I conducted, video interviews for the exhibition, talking with the curators, and they're working, all the three of them, in very different situations and scenarios. Mm-hmm. So that is part of the lab, to not only conduct the interviews, but then also to evaluate it, to assess it, you know, to analyze and write about it. The third format were workshops. So I designed two workshops, which I would, of course, somehow lead and conduct, but based on two different concepts of knowledge, like a more codified knowledge as you have, you know, in books, transferable knowledge. People write down something they know in a book, then the book travels without them and the knowledge is independent from the person, mm-hmm. as opposed to the form of knowledge which is more embedded, or which is embedded in a person, which is tacit, which doesn't exist without the person. So that was the two basic concepts of knowledge, and I was just trying to experiment a little bit. I mean, this was all just starting points. And also then to record the sessions and to evaluate that as part of it, there will, you know, that will be a sort of knowledge production. And then I had, I don't know, I think about 10, 11, 12 interviews, something like that. And it was very free. I had a list in the beginning. Irandi made a list for me of people I could meet. And it's weird to have a list of names that you do not associate anything mm-hmm. with, really. And I contacted some, and, you know, some responded, others didn't. And it just didn't happen. I thought this, for some reason, is not the way it should work. I don't want to plan it ahead and arrive and have a schedule full of appointments with people I don't know. So I wanted really to, yeah, the process to take place, you know, and see, I'm here, I spread the word, I talk to people, and something will happen. Mm. And I will just meet who I meet. Basically, I only knew one person from FemHack, Sophie, which I met in a hackers camp in Berlin a while ago. And she helped me. I mean, she was the first person I interviewed, of course, you know, I knew her. She pointed me to some interesting things in the city. So that, you know, that's how it happened. And after the talk at Concordia, people approached me. So I, you know, invited them. And the last person I talked to yesterday was Gabriella Coleman from McGill. She came to visit. And my very, very, very last interview this afternoon will be with Irandi, the curator of the show. And we will sit down and, have a look what happened in the last two weeks and discuss it. So that's the kind of knowledge, you know, it's based a lot on interaction and then afterwards reflecting on what happened. And it's not ready at all. I have the feeling it was a great first edition of the Commons Lab, and there will definitely be others mm-hmm. that will build on this one, but probably will be different in certain aspects. I think many people perceive me as a very intellectual person that is very organized and very, you know, conceptually thinking, which I partly am, I guess. But all the important things that I did in my life, I realized I did totally intuitively without knowing what I was doing, and only afterwards, when I was sitting down and reflecting, you know, I understood what I was doing. So that was pretty interesting finding. And basically that was also the same with my PhD, you know. I mean, it was PhD research, but it was practice-based research. The whole topic of art and copyright, I started because I had personally copyright problems with my work, and the show was cancelled, and so I thought, what is this copyright thing, and why does it limit my practice, and what does it have to do with art practice in general? And it was always that I first did the work, and the research was kind of then reflecting about the theory. I have the feeling I'm still in the process of this, because it's somehow not highly respected or not valued. I mean, everyone speaks about the process, and the process is also a big, big keyword in my exhibition. I have this 11 keywords. Process is one of them. And what that means, it's something really radical, I think, and it's something frightening. It's full of risk because to create this exhibition in the way I did, I think I could not have done it 10 years ago. I would have been dead scared that nothing happens or things go wrong, or, you know, I thought, well, it will happen what will happen, and whatever will happen is okay. The important thing is that you know that you set up an open system, try to keep it as open as possible, and then, you know, just trusting and see what happens. And then the difficult task is, or, you know, the second big challenge is to sit down afterwards and try to think about what actually happened. If that doesn't happen, the other things are not so valuable, I think. You know, they are still valuable, but I think sitting down afterwards and trying to understand what happens in a process that is kind of free and not directed, I think that's a big task. And then transfer this kind of knowledge. I don't like to be overly negative. Also, the situation is kind of worrying and negative at the moment. I think we always have to end the sentence or the thought or the text or the radio interview, whatever we do, with something positive that gives us power and agency, because otherwise we can just killing ourselves with our negative analysis. I think it's very important to look carefully what is actually there, and then understanding where our own agency lies. And I think there is no big theories at the moment that people could hang on to and say, yeah, if we only do this, then we'll be fine. That was a little bit the early cyberfeminism that was kind of suggesting, oh yeah, because it's digital, because it's horizontal, because the hierarchies are flat, you know, the world will automatically become a different world. Unfortunately, it didn't. So this is not a strategy. I think we have to do more. And I think the commons is quite interesting because it allows the connection of the very personal, you know, the very individual, the very private, to connect it to the very big, like how is the world run, what is capitalism doing, you know, and what does this have to do with me, you know, because it showed already, if you start talk about your gadgets, you know, now we have here on the table a mobile phone, a super high-end recording device, and, you know, iPad, and another mobile phone, and here's another mobile phone, and another computer, I mean, and a camera. I mean, you know, just the three of us, what we have flying here, if we would just, you know, freeze now and say, okay, we look into this, and what are the sketches? Where do they come from? What is the material involved? Who owns the corporations, you know, what are the labor conditions of the people who produced it. So that's only hardware. Then what is the software? What are the products we are using, you know? What are the terms of conditions, the legal restrictions, involved. What is all the stuff we have on our computers and on our laptops, you know, what we stole, what we bought, what we found, you know, all that, you know, every single item you can analyze and kind of locate in the big system, which I think the commons provides a very interesting structure for, because the commons is always about a resource and a group of people who is kind of dealing with this resource and the processes of negotiation. So you can, you know, if you look at these gadgets in terms of resources, of the involvement of who is dealing with these resources, it's the opposite of commons, you know, totally exclusive. The way the minerals and are mined, how the labor force is exploited, all that, and what do we have to do with the world? Where are we in this scenario? We cannot change the system from A to B overnight. And I think also no one would know what the new system should be like, but I think we can start with demands as customers. You say we don't want this anymore, we want that, we want certain privacy, we want labor conditions to be this and that. Also, I think another point really is when it comes to this imbalance of gender technology in terms of production and access, then we first of all have to raise awareness in this environment, which is very hard work, which some people do with code of conduct and creating safe spaces. Is a very hard process to do in such a hostile environment. And the second step, they have to acknowledge that this is happening, you know, not denying. And then I think slowly things can change. But for me, it's not really about having more women anywhere, you know, in power or something. I'm not, you know, the world won't change if there is a female. Mm. That's not the point. The systems themselves have to change. And I think, yeah, the only thing we can do is just what we're doing. Maybe a bit more focus. What I would like to do is have a regular group that meets regularly to really work on strategies and actions and demands. There are so little political demands around in this field. There are so little demands or protest against the corporations and their politics. And I think that's where we have power. And a good thing is, I think, to sit down and think about where our privileges are, not only complaining what we, you know, don't have, but what we do have. We have access to so many things, knowledge and, you know, internet, education, all of that, and think about how we can use it better.